It is time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And do have a pencil and paper handy, because there might be something you want to write down, you might want to remember, you might want to take action on. So let's get ready. Here's our final reminder. The Coastal Watershed Council is going to be having their snapshot day on Saturday, May 4th, and they'd like you to volunteer. It's only, at this point, a week away or so. This year's event is happening on Saturday, May 4th, and it was the 14th annual water quality monitoring event, providing a snapshot of water quality along 300 miles of California coastline. In order to participate in Snapshot Day, you need to have your training. And the training in Santa Cruz is happening this Saturday, April 27th, from 10 a.m. to noon, or from 1 o'clock to 3 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Yacht Harbor Public Meeting Room, 365 Lake Avenue, Suite A. And it's right next door to the Coastal Watershed Council office. So if you know where that is, it's right next door. On San Mateo, your training is next Monday, April 29th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at San Gregorio General Store. And that's located out by the coast on Highway 84 and Stage Road. It's a nice drive out there. I used to drive most of that road every day. If you're living down in Monterey, your training is coming up this Sunday from 10:30 to 12:30 p.m. That's Sunday, April 28th. And that training will happen at the REI store on General Stillwell Drive in Marina. And in San Luis Obispo, your training is next Tuesday, April 30th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Coastal Discovery Center, Hearst State Beach, San Simeon. And that's a nice drive out there, too. So learn all about the Coastal Watershed Council's Snapshot Day, their 14th annual, coming up May 4th. Get trained. Get out there. Get it done. Also coming up is the 2013 Mountain Justice Summer Action Camp. Join Mountain Justice this May 19th through the 27th for our 9th annual Mountain Justice Summer Action Training Camp. Taking place near Damascus, Virginia, Mountain Justice has grown from a fast-burning brush fire that helped push mountaintop removal to national awareness into a critical support network at the base of a growing national anti-extractive industry movement for social and environmental justice. The Mountain Justice Summer Camp is a place to learn skills, expand on the ones you already have, strengthen connections in networked social movements for justice, meet new allies, and take action to stop the destruction of Appalachia. Workshops range from mountaintop removal 101 and nonviolent civil disobedience to campaign and community organizing science and Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act. Also, Appalachian Community Economics. And they'll be training the trainers, and also expect some direct action to be part of this camp, but you don't have to participate if you don't want to. The final schedule will be released later, but you can register now at mountainjustice.org. Registration is on a sliding scale based on your ability to pay, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. They do provide 3 meals a day, a place to sleep, and amazing trainers. They expect a donation between $15 and $50 a day, or if you're going to stay for the whole camp, between $150 and $500. If you want more information, go to mountainjustice.org. And the Mountain Justice Summer Action Camp is May 19th through the 27th in or near Damascus, Virginia. And Stand Up for Native Forests, Stop Genetically Engineered Trees, Resist the Tree Biotechnology 2013 conference is going to be happening May 26th through June 1st in Asheville, North Carolina. Join the Earth First Global Justice Ecology Project and the Stop GE Trees campaign for a week of resistance to genetically engineered trees. At the end of May, the International Tree Biotechnology 2013 conference will be taking place in Asheville, North Carolina. This conference is a gathering of many of the major players in the genetically engineered tree business, and we intend to greet them with spirited protest. Timber and utility corporations want to plant millions of acres of genetically engineered trees throughout the South to burn for electricity, as well as to continue supplying the unsustainable timber and paper industries. These trees would be engineered to produce their own pesticides, grow straighter and faster, tolerate manufactured pesticides, produce sterile seeds, and reduce lignin content. If these traits escaped into native tree populations, the effects could be devastating and irreversible. The United States Department of Agriculture is already considering approving an industry request to sell billions of genetically engineered freeze-tolerant eucalyptus trees. These non-native invasives are also highly flammable and pose an unprecedented threat to the forests and communities of the southern United States. We stand to lose tens of thousands of acres of our diverse and resilient native forests to sterile monoculture tree plantations that support few, if any, native species. These protests will send a critical message to the United States Department of Agriculture as they are poised to approve the first ever commercial planting of genetically engineered eucalyptus trees in several southern states. Join activists from around the country for an action-packed week of resistance to GE trees. We are kicking off the week with a teach-in on May 27th, followed by a mass march to the conference center on the 28th, organizing and encouraging affinity group actions throughout the week to ensure the GE tree industry does not get a moment's rest during their stay in Asheville, North Carolina. For more information, contact Katua Earth First at riseup.net. That's Katua Earth First at riseup.net. And the lockdown continues in the Red River Showdown. A protester with the group Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance stopped construction on the Keystone XL pipeline by locking his arm into a concrete capsule buried directly in the pipeline's proposed path. Fitzgerald Scott, 42, is the first African-American to resist arrest while physically blockading TransCanada's dangerous tar sands pipeline, and the second person to take action this week. On Monday, a 61-year-old man locked himself to a piece of construction equipment, effectively shutting down another Oklahoma pipeline construction site. This week of action, called the Red River Showdown, is intended to protect the Red River, which marks the border between Oklahoma and Texas and is main tributary of the Mississippi. The site Scott has blockaded is a wetland area where crews are attempting to lay sections of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline directly into marshy waters. An undetected pinhole leak at this location would cause cancer-causing chemicals to mix directly into the local community water table. Scott, who has a master's degree in urban planning at the University of Illinois Chicago, is a longtime activist for social and environmental justice. While organizing against Keystone over the past 5 months, Scott has met many people struggling to protect their homes from TransCanada's abuse of eminent domain. "I am doing this for the people who don't have the financial resources to protect themselves from a bully like TransCanada," explained Scott. "Imagine how much worse it is for them, like the mostly African-American neighborhood in Winona, Texas, where protesters with the tar sands blockade found holes in the welds of a pipeline section that ran right behind a children's playground, and neither TransCanada nor the government will do anything about it." As construction of the southern portion of the Keystone XL nears two-thirds completion, no regulators or politicians show any willingness to halt the project or even inspect those faulty welds. According to George Daniels, spokesperson for the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance, "Scott's action sends a clear message. Because every other avenue has failed to stop this deadly project, we will blockade all summer and on into the fall if that's what it takes." The action comes only a few weeks after a devastating tar sands spill in Mayflower, Arkansas, which left communities across Oklahoma and Texas terrified that they may be the next victims of reckless industry practices. Survivors of the spill in Mayflower have reported nausea, blurred vision, vomiting, and blackouts caused by the same raw blend of tar and poisonous chemical solvents that will be transported through Keystone XL. Unfortunately, Scott was later extracted from his lockdown and arrested. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field. The Buffalo Field Campaign has been celebrating the coming of a few more wild baby buffalo, and we've seen many pregnant buffalo that look like they could give birth at any minute. Soon, the chocolatey brown herds will be sprinkled with tiny red calves. The next generation of wild buffalo is coming. Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have been busy day and night along Highway 191 and 287, monitoring groups of buffalo who are spending time near these highways. Thankfully, no wild buffalo have been struck by vehicles recently. We have also been busy documenting hazing operations, government actions of intolerance, which began after our last update. This past week, several groups of wild buffalo were chased off of their chosen grounds by the Denny Creek area near the South Fork of the Madison River, south of Horse Butte in the Hebgen Basin. Six different government hazing operations were conducted. Agents forced wild buffalo off of critical habitat with all-terrain vehicles and explosive cracker rounds. Agents participating in these hazes included Montana Department of Livestock Inspectors Bridger Cunningham and Mark Anderson and the Montana Fish and Wildlife Parks Warden Jim Smolzinski. Buffalo usually return to these lands shortly after the agents leave. This area is terrific habitat for all kinds of wildlife, including the federally protected threatened grizzly bear, whose signed Buffalo Field Campaign patrols have been documenting. While Montana forbids wild buffalo access here, even on public lands, this never stops the buffalo from trying to be there. In the Gardner Basin, north of Yellowstone National Park, the same group of wild buffalo were hazed again the next day after following the slain bull's scent trail that we talked about last week. Members of this same herd and an additional 20 buffalo were again hazed on Tuesday, although they were still within the tolerance zone and should have been left alone. Conducting the haze was a Montana Department of Livestock agent on an ATV and a Fish, Wildlife, and Parks agent on horseback. The Fish, Wildlife, and Parks agent was unfortunately bucked off of his horse after an aggravated buffalo bluff charged them. The operation was abandoned right at the boundary of Yellowstone National Park. While we advocate for it to cease entirely, hazing in the Gardner Basin is not supposed to occur until May 1st. And so spring hazing season has begun. We rise before dawn and take our rest very late, standing with America's last wild buffalo on their chosen ground, documenting all actions made against them. The coming weeks are going to be tough on Buffalo Field Campaign volunteers and, more importantly, for wild buffalo. With persistence, resistance, and endurance, wild buffalo adhere to their ancient earth-given rights and traditions in the face of obstacles of oppression. And here is the Buffalo Field Campaign's updated wish list for this week. They need a new refrigerator and coffee. Our current refrigerator has served us for many, many years and is now on the brink of exhaustion, and we are sorely in need of a new one. Please assist in the replacement purchase of a new commercial stand-up refrigerator. A donation of $1,000 will enable us to purchase a new refrigerator and pay for the disposal of our old one. And with the waxing sun, the Buffalo Field Campaign patrols are waking up earlier and staying in the field later, sometimes all night long, to stand with America's last wild buffalo and bear witness to the government harassment of these ancient majestic creatures. Patrols in the field with the buffalo from sunrise to sunset, and with the days becoming increasingly longer, our supply of coffee has dwindled to just a few remaining beans. And they would consider asking you to donate coffee. If you need more information, go to their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and they have a wish list there. And when you get all those donations together, send them to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957. They're located in West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the House Natural Resources Committee has done its work. Ron Stork reporting. He's the senior policy staff for Friends of the River. Representative Tom McClintock really didn't need to worry that the House Natural Resources Committee wouldn't pass his Wild Merced redesignation bill, also known as H.R. 934. Environmental groups from all over California and the country were opposed to it, of course, but that committee in this House doesn't listen to the people anyway. Still, Representative McClintock found it necessary to try and soothe his fellow committee members into compliance with stories that weren't exactly true. He's just doing this to fix the original mistake that the FERC and the Wild and Scenic Rivers boundaries don't match. Well, that's true, but they were designated for entirely different purposes so that they never match. And unlike Representative McClintock, Congress knew this when they added the river to the Wild and Scenic River system. He also claimed that it was preposterous that the expansion of the reservoir would harm the state-listed and fully protected Merced River limestone salamander because they haven't been found along the Wild and Scenic River that reach that he hopes to redesignate, which floods all the time anyway, according to him. Well, the reservoir has never backed up there, and it can't, because you really can't store any water higher than the downstream spillway. But try and explain that to a congressperson. And he also failed to tell his colleagues that the salamanders have been found along the shores of the reservoir, where they would drown if the reservoir was expanded. Not content with fairy tales, he also mounted a full-throated defense of Congress's right to change its mind on decades-old wild and scenic river designations. His fury and scorn was heaped upon the administration witness, the mild-mannered Assistant Secretary of the Interior, who told the Public Lands Subcommittee hearing members that the Department of Interior opposed the bill. Nice going, Interior, I thought. Pretty chilling stuff to hear as I attended the congressional hearing. Of course, a mere 6 days later, the full Natural Resources Committee passed H.R. 934 for consideration by the House of Representatives. What that means is that sometime in the next month or two, every congressional representative in the country will have the opportunity to vote on the fate of this small but significant reach of the Wild Merced River, along with the precedent that Congress is preparing to de-designate permanently protected wild and scenic rivers, even on the basis of the most speculative and ill-considered water projects. Of course, this House will vote to do this again, just like it did in the previous Congress. It sounds like a good time to contact your representative or your senator and provide him with your, or her, with your good and better informed advice and counsel. If you need more information on this issue, go to www.for.org. That's the Friends of the River, www.for.org. And abalone poachers have been sentenced to probation community service. They have been fined and lost their gear. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife has noted an apparent increase in abalone poaching in Southern California waters. Potential abalone poachers and the general public should be aware that wardens are on the outlook and penalties for illegally taking abalone can be stiff. Two Southern California men recently pleaded no contest to misdemeanor fish and game code violations in L.A. Superior Court. They were ordered to serve 3 years probation, pay a $2,405 fine, pay an additional $1,000 fine to the Department of Fish and Wildlife used to implement wildlife preservation policies, successfully complete a 3-to-5-unit marine biology course at a local college, serve 40 hours of community service, and forfeit all of their diving and fishing gear. Wade Anthony Curtatola of Rancho Cucamonga was diving off of Catalina Island on September 29th of last year, the opening day of lobster season. With no other boats in the area, the warden went into the water near where Curtatola surfaced behind a boat in 30 feet of water and found a spear gun and a game bag filled with horn shark, 4 abalone, and 13 lobster tails. Samples of genetic materials taken from Curtatola's equipment matched the species found in the dive bag. Curtatola pleaded to a misdemeanor counts of taking abalone in a closed area, over limits of lobster, and possession of tailed lobster. All it takes is one drop of blood or a few cells from an animal to make positive identifications of illegally taken species, said Lieutenant Eric Cord, California Department of Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement. CDFW and our partners are using the latest tools and technology to help protect California's resources. In the other instance, Bruce Allen Boyd of Oceanside, California, was fishing off of Catalina Island on the same day, September 29th of 2012, when wildlife officers boarded his boat for an inspection. Wildlife officers found a dive bag with a large abalone concealed in a trash can. The abalone was photographed and returned to the ocean. Boyd was charged with one violation and pleaded to a misdemeanor count of taking abalone in a closed area. It has been illegal to take abalone since 1997 in the southern half of the state, south of San Francisco Bay to the Mexican border, due to overfishing disease and cedar otter predation. We have seen a pretty sharp rise in abalone poaching here in Southern California over the last 18 months or so, said Cord. Most anglers are responsible fishermen and know the laws. The enforcement is to protect the resources from the rest. Illegally taking abalone has some of the highest penalties in the California Fish and Game Code and can include up to a year in jail, fines in the thousands of dollars, permanent loss of fishing licenses, and confiscation of all your fishing and diving gear. For more information, contact www.dfg.ca.gov. They haven't changed the webpage yet. www.dfg.ca.gov. And unfortunately, the northern spotted owl has been told to wait in this story by Andrew Orahusky of the Environmental Protection Information Center. On Wednesday, April 17th, EPICH argued on behalf of the northern spotted owl before the California Fish and Game Commission. Despite the fact that the species has been threatened with extinction since the 1980s and is listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act since 1990, the commission has not protected the species under California's Endangered Species Act. This significant oversight and the failure of existing federal and state regulations to promote the recovery of the owl spurred EPIC to file a petition to list the northern spotted owl under CISA last year. Unfortunately, the commission delayed action for 90 days on whether to conduct a status review under CISA. The statute clearly obligates the commission to make decisions on a specific time frame, and while this delay may be allowed under the law, it makes very little sense. The primary reason given by the commission for this delay was to further deliberate on the information provided at the last minute by the timber industry. Curiously enough, the purpose of the status review under CISA is for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the commission to analyze the available information received through an open public process. Clearly, the commission should have voted to conduct a status review based on the overwhelming evidence before it and for the very reason given for the delay. While it is well past time for the state of California to recognize its duties under CISA and to act swiftly to protect the northern spotted owl, without California Endangered Species Act protections and a more holistic view of species recovery and landscape-scale conservation that includes private and state-owned lands, the spotted owl is likely to go extinct in the foreseeable future. While the current delay is unfounded and frustrating, EPIC will continue to push for accountability and justice for the northern spotted owl. Stay tuned to Earth First Radio for more updates about this important Environmental Protection Information Center Endangered Species and Biodiversity Defense Program initiative. For more information about EPIC, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. That's www.wildcalifornia.org. And critical Lower Alameda Creek Fish Passage projects have been launched. The Alameda County Water District and the Alameda County Flood Control and Water Conservation District have put out a draft environmental review document for the proposed Lower Alameda Fish Passage Improvements Project, including construction of fish ladders at migration barriers in the Lower Alameda Creek Flood Control Channel. The projects will allow steelhead trout and salmon access through the constructed flood control channel to historic upstream spawning and rearing habitats in Upper Alameda Creek. And this is happening for the first time in half a century. The proposed projects include construction of a fish ladder at Alameda Creek Water District's Rubber Dam No. 1 and at the Bart Weir, construction of a fish ladder at Alameda Creek Water District's Upper Rubber Dam, replacement of an existing rubber dam bag, and construction of a new diversion and fish screening facility at Shin Pond, and decommissioning of the existing unscreened diversion pipelines. The Alameda Creek Water District will also modify water bypass rates in the stream reach of Alameda Creek below Mission Boulevard to enhance flow and depth conditions for anadromous steelhead and other fish species. Alameda Creek Water District and the Alameda Creek Flood Control District will develop and implement a joint operation and maintenance plan for the fishways and associated facilities. Construction is planned to start next year and should be completed in 2015. If your organization would sign on to a letter in support of this project, please contact Jeff Miller at the Alameda Creek Alliance. That email address is jeff@alamedacreek.org. And if you want more information, go to www.alamedacreek.org. And lower fishing limits have been rejected by a judge in this story by Bob Agelko of the San Francisco Chronicle. A federal judge has rejected an environmental group's attempt to require the government to lower its catch limits for sardines, mackerel, and other forage fish off of the California coast. The organization, Oceana, claimed that the plan approved by the National Marine Fisheries Service in 2010 was based on flawed data and allowed fishing at levels that would deplete offshore populations of several species. Those fish are part of the food chain for other fish, seabirds, and whales, but U.S. District Judge Edward Chen of San Francisco said that the federal agency had simply reaffirmed or in some cases tightened the harvesting limits it had set for the same forage species in 2000. Chen ordered the Fisheries Service to reconsider its catch levels for one species, the northern anchovy, saying the agency had reopened that subject in 2010 but failed to determine the limits needed to protect the fish. That decision is required, he said, in a 1976 conservation law designed to prevent overfishing. But Chen said it was too late to challenge the rules the agency established in 2000 and reaffirmed in 2010 for the Pacific sardine, the Pacific mackerel, the jack mackerel, and the market squid. Oceana also challenged the Fisheries Service's conclusion that its 2010 plan would cause no ecological harm and that a full environmental study was therefore not required. But the judge said the 2010 plan was, by its very terms, has no negative impact. The California Wet Fish Producers Association said the ruling was important for fisheries based on Monterey Bay and several Southern California ports. Those fisheries are closely monitored by the federal and state governments and have one of the lowest harvest rates in the world, the association said. Fishermen in California and the West Coast are breathing a little easier today, said the association's executive director, Diane Pleschner-Steele. She said Oceana's lawsuit was riddled with sensationalist claims based on unproven findings. The environmental group was dismayed. At a time when sardine populations are collapsing and sea lions are starving on the beach, the judge's failure to reach a decision on how to protect the ecosystem maintains the status quo and allows the fishing industry to drive ecologically crucial populations of forage species to further decline, said Oceana's California director Jeff Schuster. The organization said it would continue to press for tighter limits before the Fisheries Service in Congress and in the courts. And if you'd like more information, go to www.oceana.org. That's www.oceana.org. And young salmon are finding their way in the San Joaquin River in this story by Mark Grossi of the Fresno Bee. Donald Ports performed surgery in a parking lot at Lost Lake near Frant Dam. Within minutes, his patients are awake and taking the swim of their lives in the San Joaquin River. Ports is a federal fisheries biologist, one of many scientists and engineers working on an epic project reviving California's second longest river and rebuilding the nation's southernmost salmon runs. Sometimes that means standing next to a pickup near the river and surgically inserting tiny transmitters or tags into resilient juvenile salmon. We might lose one fish in 1,000, Port said, but with these tags, we will be able to track these fish all their lives. Following these 3-inch fish is a priority in the fourth year of a restoration program on the San Joaquin, and its progress as a program that has had its share of hurdles, such as construction delays and damaged downstream farmland. Scientists need to understand how these tiny fish will pass through the river to the Pacific Ocean. Are there blockages? How many will disappear in stretches where there are predator fish? The San Joaquin revival is supposed to move beyond this experimentation to the full restoration in the next several years, so these kinds of questions need answers. And unfortunately, we don't have time to read that full article, but they are definitely working on getting the San Joaquin River restored. You've been listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz and is a production of Earth First Radio. The show airs at 9 o'clock on Thursday night and is rebroadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoons. If you'd like to listen to the Earth First Update in Moscow, Idaho, you can do it on Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 FM, KRFP. And that show airs Monday night at 9:30. If you'd like to listen to a podcast or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update, you can do that at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number forall.net. And we want to thank you for listening. And if you could please tune in next week.